This is Tidings from Hazel Kahn. I'm very pleased today to introduce you to Rebecca Wilkommersen, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, an organization that brings to Americans an important perspective on Israel's occupation of Palestine. I'm proud that WPKN Radio can provide a listening place for a voice we don't hear often enough. So welcome very much to the show, Rebecca. Talk to us a little bit about your job, about your title, about your organization.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show. Yes, Jewish Voice for Peace is an American Jewish organization. We're a national membership organization, and we're inspired by Jewish tradition to work for a just resolution to what's happening in Israel and Palestine based on the principles of human rights, equality, and international law. We have chapters around the country, somewhere between 35 and 40 chapters. We have about 125,000 online supporters. We have a growing rabbinical council, so lots of different kinds of activity going on.
And who would you say are these 125,000 people online?
That's a really great question. You know, to be honest, we've never done a survey of or anything, and we don't ask people to tell us who they are when they sign up. And I know that for our online supporters, I think we have a broader cross-section of the American and even the international public. I know that in our chapters and our other formations, the vast majority of our activists are Jewish and American, but we do have some folks who are not Jewish who have also become very active in Jewish Voice for Peace.
Jewish is a word that doesn't in one sense mean anything, because there are so many varieties of Jews, which I'm sure your audience reflects as well. I mean, everything from very conservative ones to almost non-Jews in a way. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of people's identity as Jews, I think it runs the spectrum from, you know, people who identify culturally or historically as Jewish but don't have any sort of Jewish practice at all, to people who are very committed synagogue members, to people who are doing alternative chaburot. I've been involved with JVP long enough to have known folks who have done all those things. So yeah, so I mean, you know, being Jewish is sort of a self-identified category in a way, and people experience it in various different ways.
And one of the other things about that Jewish identity is that it changes within for any given individual. I imagine you could probably talk about how your own Jewish consciousness, identity, activism has changed over the years.
Yeah, I actually think I am a great example. I grew up in a conservative synagogue that my grandparents had founded. I was bat mitzvahed. I was confirmed. Very strong connections to Israel because my father's family all lived in Israel. As I was in my early 20s, I sort of maintained some Jewish practice, but in some ways less and less so, which I think is probably pretty typical in the life cycle. I then ended up meeting and marrying an Israeli man, and so I lived in Israel for 3 years. Sort of ironically, the years that I was in Israel was sort of when I was least connected to my actual Jewish practice. It's quite hard to be, in some ways, your Judaism is all around you when you live in Israel. But in other ways, the Jewish practice is somewhat limited to an Orthodox variety that I wasn't really that comfortable with. So I wasn't very, apart from living in Israel, I wasn't very active Jewishly. Now that I'm back in New York and I have children who are school age, you know, now I'm a synagogue member again, my children are going to Hebrew school. My identity as a Jewish person remains constant. And I think, you know, and it is some separate but connected to the political activism as a Jewish organization. As an organization, we're not a religious organization in the least. But many people come to the organization because they want to feel at home as a Jewish person practicing politics that they believe in, which unfortunately has been very, very hard to do on this issue in particular.
But are you saying that your Jewish political views and identity have changed as well over the years?
Well, I think personally for myself, like I said, growing up, I had very, very strong connections to Israel through my father's family and going back and forth to Israel over the years. And then my experiences, my personal experience with Israel and in Palestine changed when I was living there. I think it took me a while to be willing to grapple with the issues of Israel and Palestine as a Jewish American. And I think that I already had very strong other progressive or even left politics on other issues, and I at some point came, it was in around the Second Intifada actually, that I realized that I needed to apply my principles consistently. And so if I was going to believe, for example, that people should be equal regardless of their religion or their race, which I certainly do believe as an American, especially as a minority growing up in America, then I had to apply those principles to Israel as well. So I definitely came to a point in my life probably about 10 years ago, where I was able to articulate well my politics around Israel and Palestine, and thereafter was active around that issue. I think since then, my core principles haven't changed. You know, the way we do the activism maybe has shifted over the years, but that's remained constant.
At that time, when you said 10 years ago, I don't know, it was whether it was a transition or whether you were actually bringing together your progressive values and your Jewish values. I mean, they were not in the same place at that time. You had to bring them together. Is that right?
I was always a political person, and I became more political in my sort of, you know, the years post-college. And I always had some vague concerns about what was happening and some of the things that Israel was doing. And I wasn't confident enough to argue those positions because of the cost it took. You know, I had to argue with my father, and I had to argue with my family, and I think that's a very typical thing that many people do, is they avoid the issue because it's very emotionally fraught and can be difficult, and you can risk alienating friends and family and community and that sort of thing. And then I did come to a moment when I realized, hey, this is something that's important in my life, and I need to articulate to myself and educate myself about what my principles are around this and speak out on this just like I would on any other issue. So I do think it was a coming together of those, the principles I already had with this issue, but it also was a transition. I had never before spoken out as a Jewish person on a political issue, and to have that identity politics be part of my political action was certainly something new.
For some people, it's really very traumatic. You know, it's the kind of thing that can split families and then can end friendships and so on, and also bring people together by the same token. The whole idea of PEP, of progressive except on Palestine, do you see that these days? I mean, are there a lot of people out there who you wish would join JVP and share your views, but who are just not able to make the bridge? Or to integrate, really, the two sets of values.
This is one of the most astonishing and for me frustrating phenomena that I encounter, which is this, like you said, this progressive except Palestine thing, where people can articulate so well their really deeply held values around human rights and equality and, you know, the need for, you know, for people to live their lives in dignity and freedom. And then suddenly when it comes to Israel, those principles disappear, and I find that to be very, very difficult. And I think that's one of JVP's big pieces of work, is helping people to integrate and to be able to come out on this issue. And you know, it is very interesting. We definitely have people who are deep inside the what I would call the mainstream Jewish world who, you know, give us money anonymously, or will sidle up to us in conversations and say, "Hey, I really support the work you do, but I can't say it out loud." And that happens a lot. And so I think, you know, we see a lot of parallels with the queer liberation struggles, where it really is this sort of coming out process, and each person who is able to come out makes it easier for the next person to come out and to sort of normalize, you know, having these politics and being in the world as a Jewish person. So I think, you know, that's definitely a big part of the work that we're doing.
Just to focus specifically on this, helping people make the transition or the integration, whichever way you want to look at it, what specifically do you do at JVP to that end?
What we do more than anything else is that we're visible, and that we speak in our local communities, and at the same time are proud to express our political values around this issue. I mean, in a specifically Jewish sense, our rabbinical council, for example, puts together materials around holidays like Pesach and Rosh Hashanah and other holidays like that to sort of integrate traditional Jewish events and integrate these issues into them and sort of help people identify their Jewish values. And the more visible we are, the more people see us in the media, the more people see us in their communities, the easier it is for them to say, "Hey, that's me too."
And I was wondering, it was, you know, a lot of the stuff you just said is sort of behavioral, in the sense that this is how you do Pesach, this is how you do whatever. Some of it is so personal, it's almost as if you need little sort of workshops for people to, you know, in the psychological model of people coming to terms with other things in their lives, whatever they may be. I mean, there's so much of that going on out there. I was wondering, it's almost like if you're a sort of caught on the fence Jew who's just really trying to integrate himself or herself. I mean, do you have any like little workshops about that sort of thing?
Yeah, we have. We've done trainings for our local chapters about how to have difficult conversations with friends and family and community, sort of thing, and talk to people about how to articulate their values and find values in common and that sort of thing. I think You know, it's hard work. And like you said, it, what's very interesting about it is that for a lot of people, it's emotional. It's not about just knowing the facts. You know, people have to sort of cross a, many people have to cross a sort of emotional barrier in order to first understand for themselves and later to be able to sort of articulate out loud what their positions are. So you know, yeah, I think a lot of the work is very much one-on-one, and we do our best to help folks, to give them tools to help people talk about it. But I do think very much it's about helping, sitting with people and saying to them, what are your values? What do you think is important as a citizen and as a person in the world? And then from that, say, well, if those are your values, do you think that, you know, then how do you extrapolate from that what's happening in Israel and Palestine, and why, you know, why it's important to sort of fight for a just resolution to it? Why, if we consider ourselves to be equal citizens in the United States, which I think we all do, and I think, you know, we have values around what citizenship is, then shouldn't that also be true in Israel and Palestine? Shouldn't people have access to education and access to healthcare and access to just freedom of movement generally and to expression of their culture and all the sorts of things that Palestinians under the occupation don't have access to? And so I think that, you know, that's a conversation that often takes a long time. It's not something that you have one conversation and then someone suddenly changes their mind. And it's sort of interesting. I always ask people what their own sort of transformation story is. And I'm always hoping that I'm going to find one theme and one answer about that, you know, that everyone has that same like aha moment. But what I've found is that there isn't one answer, that different people come to it for different reasons and have different moments of clarity around it.
People come from so many different backgrounds, there couldn't possibly be a single path, you know, to the transformation. And there's the whole sense of betrayal, I think, that a lot of people feel.
It's scary, you know, it's scary exactly from a sense of identity, and are you going to lose your sense of identity, and are you going to be accused of scary things? And also it's about the many of the stereotypes and misinformation that many of us have been brought up with, you know, around the Arabs are trying to throw us into the sea. I mean, I certainly learned that as a kid. So it takes some unlearning to figure that out, too.
Rebecca Vilcomason, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, is talking about how her organization is trying to influence citizen consciousness and government policy about the Israeli occupation. Let's talk now more about JVP. Do you consider it a mainstream Jewish organization?
25,000 people on our online supporting group. That's not a not insignificant number of people. I wouldn't say we're the mainstream, but I would say we're a mainstream. We're a significant portion of the Jewish community at this point. And how we're different from the Jewish community are certainly that our principles, again, are around sort of universal principles as opposed to, I would say, maybe more ethnocentric principles. The fact that, you know, there's sort of the key points of contention and the reason we're controversial in the Jewish world, I think, boil down to two. One is that we don't take a position on one state or two states. Our position is that as an American organization, we're responsible for American policy in the region, and that the United States has enabled Israel to continue the occupation and continue all its policies of discrimination against Palestinian people by, you know, offering incredible amounts of economic and military and diplomatic support for Israel, and that it's our responsibility to change American policy, and that Israelis and Palestinians are responsible for figuring out how to live together. So we don't take a position on one or two states. Although, again, we would say, you know, we don't want to see a state that's discriminatory towards any kind of person, and we would take a position on that in principle. If that can be worked out in a two-state solution, great. If it can be worked out in a one-state solution, also great. But I think two-state has become a real dogma for folks around what's acceptable in the Jewish community. So that's a key point of contention. But I'm very proud of the fact that we take that position, and I think it's a very fair one. The other way that we differ from other Jewish organizations is that we're active in boycott, divestment, and sanctions. We have endorsed boycott and divestment campaigns focusing on the occupation, and we are the founders of one of the largest divestment campaigns happening in the United States right now, which is to get TIAA-CREF, which is the largest pension fund in the United States, to divest from companies profiting from the occupation. The BDS movement has been really demonized and attacked by mainstream Jewish communities, and so the fact that we have allied ourselves with that movement has meant that a lot of people have criticized us. But again, I think that boycott, divestment, and sanctions have been used as a nonviolent tool for righteous struggles all around the world throughout history. So I'm very proud of it as a nonviolent way that everybody can take action on this issue.
So BDS, which is boycott, divestment, sanctions, was originally, I believe, initiated by the Palestinians themselves, saying, you know, this is what we want to do. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. And I think that's a very important element of it. I mean, it's very, you know, I think we think about solidarity and the idea that it's important to be in solidarity with the people who are struggling under the occupation. If this is a way that they've asked us as allies to take action, then that's an important factor.
And so the form that it takes, can you be a bit more specific? Because people don't know about BDS.
It's really three different ways of using economic tools to express discontent with state policies. An example of a way that products that people are boycotting, there's a great campaign called Solem Beauty, which targets Ahava, which is a Israeli cosmetics firm, which sells products made from mud that's being taken out of the West Bank, which is occupied territory, and selling it for profit. And so we're asking people to boycott using Ahava products as a way of saying that we don't want to be complicit in the occupation. Divestment is asking people not to invest in companies that are profiting from what's happening in Israel and Palestine. And I should pause here for a minute and clarify that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has three main goals. It's a rights-based movement, and their main goals are ending the occupation and tearing down the wall, equal rights for Palestinian citizens inside of Israel, and the right of return for refugees around the world. And all of these fall within international law, and we do support all of those rights in principle. JVP has decided specifically to focus on occupation-related boycott and divestment efforts. So we limit the kinds of campaigns that we participate in to those that are related to the occupation specifically. But the boycott, divestment, sanction movement globally has not limited itself in that way. So divestment, yes, Caterpillar, we just had a great victory. JVP has been working against Caterpillar for 7 or 8 years now. Caterpillar sends huge bulldozers, enormous weaponized bulldozers, which have been used to destroy orchards and tear down trees and destroy homes. And perhaps most famously, it was a Caterpillar bulldozer that killed American activist Rachel Corrie when she was standing in front of a home about to be demolished in the Gaza Strip back in 2003. So a broad coalition of groups all around the country, human rights organizations, the Rachel Corrie Foundation, groups like Amnesty International, Catholic Orders, Jewish Voice for Peace, the U.S. Campaign, all kinds of groups have been doing a campaign for a long time now to get Caterpillar to stop selling bulldozers to the Israeli army.
The Presbyterian Church, too, no?
Presbyterians and the Methodists this year, there was a strong effort to get them to divest from Caterpillar as a company profiting from the occupation. In the case of the Presbyterians, it failed by one vote, which was extremely disappointing. But, you know, things are going in the right direction. A few years ago, we couldn't even get a vote on the floor, and this time it could have gone either way. And we did get a really great victory because TIA Cref divested its social choice fund from Caterpillar. So basically they took 72 to Israel and to Palestinians, acceptable behavior. So it's not that we think that, you know, TIA Cref, you know, ridding its social choice fund of $72 million of Caterpillar stock is going to end the occupation. But we have seen in previous struggles like the South African apartheid struggle or the civil rights struggle in the United States, the Great Boycott, you know, all kinds of different struggles around the world against Nestle's in Africa a couple decades ago, that this has been a very, very effective tool for education and economic action.
Did you include sanctions, a description of sanctions and how that's different from boycott and divestment?
Sanctions are government-imposed boycotts, essentially. And so the United States, for example, right now has sanctions on Iran in objection to its nuclear plans. And so, you know, eventually we would like to see there to be government sanctions on Israel. We're very far from that place in the United States. So right now we're focusing more on boycott and divestment.
As far as you know, do some people who practice BDS, do they also refrain from traveling to Israel?
I have met people who talked to people who refrain from traveling to Israel. And I mean, that's a personal decision that obviously people can make. It's not part of the BDS call. Nobody is not part of what Palestinians are asking in solidarity. Certainly anyone should make whatever ethical decision they make about where they travel or what they buy or that sort of thing. But that's not part of the BDS movement.
How do you see American Jewish opinion on Israel changing in the last generation? Is this something that moves very slowly, or does it move in sort of spurts? I mean, did did Romney's visit to Israel make a difference to, in those ways, or is it just something that just moves really, really slowly? What do you see?
That's a great question, and another one of these sort of, you know, deep questions about what makes social movements successful at a particular time. And I think sort of all of the above. I think it moves slowly and quickly and in spurts. So, for example, at JVP, we always talk about having sort of classes of members sort of come in at different times. And the second intifada was a time that a lot of new members came in. The war on Gaza was a time that a lot of new members came in. But I also think there's a slow and steady generational change that is occurring. And I think that partially has to do with the immediate post-Holocaust generation, you know, getting older and older and really dying out, and a younger generation that's less connected to the Holocaust. It's not that the Holocaust is less important necessarily, but that what they know of Israel, you know, they've grown up with Israel since Israel became an occupying power. At the same time, they don't have the immediate specter of the Holocaust holding them back from criticizing Israel. So they see Israel as an occupying power that is, you know, on a daily basis perpetrating human rights abuses on Palestinians. They don't have a memory of any time before then. And so that makes things very, very different. Rather than Israel being seen as a beacon of light unto the world, as it was seen in the immediate post-World War II decades, which, to be honest, you know, wasn't very accurate either. I mean, Israel is a country, and countries do bad things and good things. Every country around the world does that. And Israel was founded, you know, as a result of a terrible, terrible disaster in world history, the Holocaust. But it also, as part of its birth, it started the Nakba, which was, you know, many Palestinians were forced out of their homes and lost their homes and lands. And so both of those things are part of Israel's founding. So
not only founding, I must say, but it continues today.
Exactly. I think that's my point, is that it's not that it started during the occupation. It's been an ongoing process of displacement of Palestinian people from its founding and even before its founding, which, you know, we really want to make sure that we're talking about. It's not that just the occupation will end and everything's hunky-dory. That's why I think it's very important to talk about Palestinian and Israeli citizens and their rights and their equality, as well as ending the occupation. But be that as it may, I think in terms of the generational shift in the United States, in this country, it makes a difference the fact that for the younger generations, they know Israel as an occupier, not as a refuge for refugees who have just survived the worst, you know, one of the worst catastrophes of the 20th century, but as a place that's, you know, a country that has the fourth largest military in the world, that's supported by the largest military in the world, and is oppressing Palestinians on a daily basis. So that makes a difference about how people see it. So we do see that our, probably like many social movements, that the greatest dynamism and greatest change is coming from the younger generation.
Do you find a lot of anti-JVP activity when you do have your meetings or protests or actions anywhere? Do you encounter a lot of hostility from the other side, whatever the other side might be?
On occasion, we have. One example is the groups, and this is actually one of my frustrations with the organized Jewish community. There's a group called Stand With Us, which has threatened violence and actually been violent with JVP members. You know, called us, you know, every horrible name in the book you can imagine, everything from capo to, you know, all kinds of curses. We had an occasion when Stand With Us members came in and pepper sprayed, disrupted and pepper sprayed our members at a meeting. That was probably we get hate mail every day to our office, that sort of thing. Stand With Us is an organization that is accepted as part of the Jewish community, in the mainstream Jewish community, despite this violence and threats of violence. So that's very frustrating for us, that the mainstream Jewish community has not called out this sort of really thuggish behavior, violent behavior from right-wing organizations, but at the same time feels it's okay to criticize us, which are, you know, advocating and acting only in nonviolent ways. So yeah, you know, we get hate mail, we get disruptions at meetings. That's not the norm. That's the occasional, but certainly, and it is interesting to me that years ago we used to get a lot more dissent at meetings and that sort of thing. Nowadays we get a lot less of that, and I think that's probably part of the indication of things changing. But it is a constant struggle and kind of pushback that we do get from people, and it tends to be quite ugly when it happens. Not based in facts, based in emotions.
So then my last question to you is, how do you think that U.S. policy of what is essentially total support for Israel and the occupation, can it be changed? Is it changing? Do you feel your efforts are having any impact on policy?
I mean, it absolutely can be changed, right? We have the examples, you know, I think South African apartheid is a great example. The United States was the last country to end its support of South Africa. But when it did, that's what really tipped apartheid into its ending phase. We have had serious changes in U.S. culture and changes in attitude and understanding of different issues. I think LGBT rights are a great example. Women's rights are a great example. The civil rights movement is a great example. So it certainly is possible. What we see at this moment is that U.S. policy has not changed. President Obama, in fact, just increased Israeli aid a little bit. It's not a matter of Democrat or Republican. Whichever administration is in control has kept its policies consistent, consistently in favor of Israel with, you know, enormous amounts of military aid for a long time. But we do see shifts. I mean, I think obviously nothing, I couldn't say that, you know, there's something shifting within government policies now. But, you know, we start to see even people in the Pentagon and in the military starting to say things like Israel's not, you know, this kind of level of support for Israel is not in the strategic interests of the United States, which as someone who's progressive, I'm not sure that that's a good argument to depend upon, but it is an interesting sign that understanding of this issue is shifting in the establishment. And I think, you know, it's a question of building movement and that we have to have enough strength to be able to change votes. And that's what we're doing by building chapters and across the country and membership across the country and building our youth wing and building our rabbinical support, that eventually we will be able to be strong enough to go through Congress and force policy change through Congress, just like other social movements have done so. We're not at that moment yet, but that's what we're working toward.
And of course, the elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned is APAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, APAC, yeah, the lobby group. And I mean, that it appears to me from the outside that its strength has not in any way diminished. So that's really, it's when you say it's not the Democrats or the Republicans, what it really is, it's APAC.
APAC, but it's not APAC alone. You also have the Christian evangelicals, which are actually much bigger than APAC. You have the military industrial complex, the military companies, and the military aid that goes to Israel is required to go through American companies. So American military equipment companies get, you know, great contracts and profits from this. So, you know, I wouldn't want to say it's just APAC. I think it's, you know, it's a triumvirate of a lot of different issues. But the end result is, of course, that regardless of whether politicians personally have an understanding of what's going on, in order to be elected, their understanding at the moment is still that they need to toe a certain line. And so our goal is to change that. You know, and to some extent, it's a reputational change. It's making sure that...
A what change?
A reputational change. I mean, I think sometimes I think that APAC is feared based on its reputation more than its actual actions. And you only need to disprove it a few times, I think, in order for that air of invulnerability to be challenged. So I think, you know, eventually that's where we'd like to go. And it's a matter of, like I said, of building our strength as a grassroots movement to counter the enormous amounts of money that are currently able to go to candidates.
So thank you very much, Rebecca. I really am so glad to have had this chance to talk to you and to you know, let your voice be heard.
Thank you so much for having us. And if anyone wants to know more, you can look at our website, www.jvp.org.
Great. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Tidings. Rebecca Vilcomason, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, has been talking about the role JVP is playing in changing policy and consciousness on issues surrounding Israel's occupation of Palestine. This and other Tidings programs are archived at WPKN.org and available as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.